They learn. I think this is all, life is a learning process. You know, even you, Tina, this for many years, you know, like I still feel like, yes, somebody may consider an expert, but at the end of the day, you know, you're still learning from life. Life is a learning process. You can also provide with information that if this is something that is not available near you, what other options do we have? For example, if we have somebody in the community that in order to see a patient that in order to get to the next academic center is like 3 or 4 hours away from where they are, and it's very difficult for that patient, you know, to travel. But the reality is that it's hard to replicate, right, what is happening on the mice to humans. And the percentage of drug that has been approved when that process has been achieved is less than 5%.
Bridging the gap between local community hospitals and practicing physicians and these large academic centers where, you know, it's part of the water, like, what do they call it? The, you know, discussion by the water cooler.
Welcome, everybody, to the Clinical Trial Files. I'm Tamia, and I'm joined today by my brilliant co-hosts, Karen and Roberto, and one of my dear friends and a guest today, Dr. Heidi Del Rivero, who is a triple board certified powerhouse, if you will, whose work is changing the outlook across the globe on rare endocrine cancers. So welcome, Heidi. We're happy to have you today. Quick question before we like jump into the nitty gritty. If you could give your career a book title, what would that be?
God, I have to think about it. Okay. Adventures, maybe? I would say like it's a title, like I would just say like there is a, your destiny may not be a one line, you know, moving forward. Because life is like always unexpected, right? And it's always like one line that tells you you're going from point A to point B. So it's always kind of like little roadblocks, if you call it. So, and it's always good from those, you know, from those experiences as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. So Heidi, I'm going to start by jumping into something a little more serious now. So, a couple different scenarios. Would you rather have to explain IRB paperwork to a group of toddlers or give grand rounds wearing roller skates?
Oh. She's waiting for the serious.
Very serious question.
Well, I think we'll prefer to discuss it with a toddler.
Why is that?
Yeah. I feel that for me is trying to explain in a way that somebody will understand and see that aspect of understanding and growing. You know, that's kind of like me very excited to see. I see it with my patients. I see it, you know, when I explain something that they have not heard before or that they don't understand. And I try to explain it like if I were a 4 or 5 year old person, you know, I feel like that to me provides more insight. And when they see like, oh, it makes sense, to me, it brings me so much satisfaction.
It's actually a very kind and thoughtful and relevant answer. I would have picked the roller skating, but I think that your answer is actually really lovely. So I appreciate you saying that.
If you were going to just give us a about the biggest challenge or biggest advantage of the difference of moving from another country to the U.S. and receiving your training here in the U.S., what would that be?
Well, originally from Mexico, from a city called Veracruz. I came here to the United States, I would say more like about 25 years ago. I was doing my internal medicine residency. I never wanted to do oncology. You know, and one of the reasons is because my mom is a cancer survivor. So she was with endometrial cancer, you know, going through the process and seeing other patients that were experiencing the same. I was like, never wanted to do oncology. So even when I was doing my internal medicine residency, I avoided doing the rotations in medical oncology. I did hematology. I thought that was nice, but I avoided anything related with medical oncology. I had an interest in endocrinology and that's what I wanted to do. I did my fellowship in endocrinology. And the thing is like, I wanted to do bone and mineral metabolism. So NIH is already a research institution. You have to choose a mentor. And all I wanted to do is study bone and mineral metabolism, osteoporosis, vitamin D deficiency. You know, that's kind of like what I thought I was going to do. But here at the NIH, there is a mini match. So the mentors can only choose one mentor. And I remember that I choose my number one mentor, but he didn't choose me. So I went with my last option, believe it or not. And that was with the expert on paraffeos. So I was crying. I was like, oh, I spent my vacation, my time off trying to study this two more times, you know, because it's like, this is what I wanted to do. But I still needed to finish my training. So I said, okay, let me just try, you know, learn the best I can. And then that's how I started to see paraffeos. And that's kind of like how I got interested in paraffeos and how, you know, that there is no treatment options. And then I left NIH, took a position at New York City, Albert Einstein, to help build the endocrine oncology program. That's when I was exposed to neuroendocrine tumors and other, you know, cancers. And I was like, wow, I feel like maybe this could be an area where I hope to help patients because there is not that many treatment options. And I was seeing on those patients their frustrations. And I came back and did the medical oncology fellowship.
Mm-hmm. Was that attracted you to endocrinology? What was the attraction to that particular field, which made you want to pursue it?
Yeah, I think it was when I was seeing these patients with pheochromocytomas and paragangliomas and patients that had a metastatic disease. Back then, there was not approved FDA agent. MIBG was just approved in the last, I think it was 2018, and the company is not making MIBG anymore. But before that, I mean, there was no treatment options whatsoever that were approved by the FDA. So a lot of some of the recommendations may have been in some expertise and enrolling patients on phase one studies and maybe some limited data from Europe, but it was very difficult for patients. I think what I was seeing in those patients is a lot of the uncertainty, felt isolated, felt that nobody understood their disease, that they didn't have hope. I felt their how much they suffer. And I just feel that, you know, maybe I can just be a support to them. And then I start getting more involved in the field.
Very compassionate. It sounds like your compassion really drove you to that, in addition to there being a real need. So I think that's a really wonderful reason to go into any type of field, whatever you choose to do. But it's wonderful.
Yeah. For those listening, you treat very rare cancers, right? And so can you give just a little bit on what pheopara is, you know, what ACC is and what neuroendocrine tumors are as a whole, just because we're going to mention that a lot throughout the conversation.
Oh, yeah. Great. Thank you so much. So, yes, I mean, let's start what are neuroendocrine tumors. So neuroendocrine tumors are very unique type of cancer that can be anywhere in the body. Most commonly, the neuroendocrine tumors has been seen in the GI tract, like colon and small bowel, pancreas, appendix, and the whole GI tract, and also in the lungs. There is a very rare subset of neuroendocrine tumors in the adrenal gland. It's called pheochromocytomas that arise from the central nervous system, the neural cell crest, and also within the body, we also have this paraganglia change, which, you know, it could be anywhere from the neck, chest, abdomen, and pelvis, and that also arise from the nervous system. And depending on where they are, they could be also paragangliomas of the head and neck or paragangliomas of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis. Under the microscope, there is really not that much difference, but based on where they're located biologically, maybe a little bit different. But again, this is a rare subset of neuroendocrine tumors as well. And another type of cancer that I see within the adrenal gland is called adrenocortical carcinoma. This doesn't arise from the neural cell crest, so doesn't have this neuroendocrine differentiation, but sometimes we group them with the neuroendocrine tumors just because this is a very orphaned type of cancer that also don't have treatment options. The only approved agent for adrenocortical carcinoma is called mitotem, which is quite toxic, and that was approved in the 1950s. Other than that, anything else after that. Going back to the neuroendocrine tumors, I said, you know, it could be anywhere in the body. They're called neuroendocrine tumors because they have specific markers that make the neuroendocrine tumors, but also they have the capacity to produce hormones and peptides. Sometimes these hormones can also produce symptoms. Depending on what hormones they produce, they have a very specific clinical presentation. Now, going back to the pheochromocytomas and paragangliomas, they have the capacity to produce catecholamines and metanephrines. So pheochromocytomas in the adrenal gland, paragangliomas is outside the adrenal gland, anywhere from the head, chest, abdomen, pelvis. if the paragangliomas isn't the localized on the neck area, and they're usually biochemically silent. So it's got like the difference between the pheochromocytomas and paragangliomas compared to other neuroendocrine tumors. And the adrenocortical carcinoma, they arise from the adrenal cortex, where they can also produce hormones. And that's kind of like what my endocrine, you know, background, they an important role on me trying to study these tumors. All of these tumors tend to metastasize, and some of these tumors may be more aggressive than others. And based on how they behave, we treat these tumors quite personalized. And that's usually what I tell to my patients. It's not like one size fits all. We treat the patient and provide the options. And some of these options could be multimodality options between different specialties, surgery, interventional radiologies, nuclear medicine, medical oncologies, endocrinologies. So that's why this type of neuroendocrine tumors, they're very unique and an unmet need as well, because some of these tumors, we don't have that many treatment options. So I think this is certainly an unmet need.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your ability to, you know, you treat the endocrine side, the medical oncology side, that's very rare. Not a lot of, I would say you're probably one of max a handful, if there are even a handful, that have this dual board certification in these specialties. Do you feel like that changes the way that you design the trial for the endocrine malignancies versus the neuroendocrine malignancies? And then how do you design a trial for this rare subset of patients, right? You're talking about a very hyper individualized approach. How do you create a broad study that encompasses these patients and accomplishes the same goals?
So in terms of understanding the disease and the disease biology, I mean, I think neuroendocrine tumor experts, I would say, we acquire a lot of the same knowledge and understanding. Sometimes there may be a difference on how sometimes we provide certain treatment algorithms. That's kind of like a lot of those decisions is based on their expertise, on what they have used in terms of the treatment modalities. But as I mentioned earlier, I mean, a lot of these hormones, they do produce hormones and they have different symptomatology. And in that situation, for me, it's easier to manage the hormone excess. And I see that more in the parapheos and the adrenocortical carcinoma, where they produce these hormones and they need to work with their endocrinologists in order to help them to manage the hormone excess. That sometimes I have seen that it's difficult to sometimes get an appointment with endocrinologists. But then in order to get an appointment with them, sometimes it's kind of like 3 months, 6 months. Patients don't have that time, you know, to wait this time to control the symptoms related to hormone excess. So that's, I have seen that, and I wish there will be an easier way to get an appointment sooner with an endocrinologist, or maybe have more endocrinologists who have an expertise and interest in treating these neuroendocrine tumors, because they're busy in their clinic. There is so much diabetes, so much obesity, thyroid. I mean, and sometimes, you know, it's harder to get an appointment sooner. And sometimes oncologists trying to manage some of the endocrine excess, which I can imagine. And some of them, I'm not saying everyone, may be a little bit challenging for that. Sure. I can do that. And it's very easy to manage that part of the symptoms related to hormone excess, because that's something that I learned how to do during my training and by seeing patients and so forth. So that's something that I feel comfortable doing that. That said, you know, I do feel like, you know, if we can have more endocrinologists who focus, like maybe that would be even easier for patients. In terms of, as you questioned, how do we manage clinical trials? How do we influence some of the endpoints of clinical study? I think in terms of hormone excess, they have a very specific symptoms that can interfere with quality of life. I think that by having an endpoint of quality of life within the clinical trials, that will be important as well to assess. And also an endpoint to try to see whether a specific agent can also have an effect on the hormones and how that lower the hormones as well, besides having the tumor control. Most of the medical oncology's endpoints in terms of either primary or secondary endpoints is usually either progression-free survival, overall survival for neuroendocrine tumors of these very slow-growing cancers may not be necessarily a primary endpoint, because we know that these patients can also live long time, but also for other endpoints common in medical oncology is also radiographic response. But quality of life, not something that is used, or hormonal control, sometimes not something that is used. But I think some of them may be important to understand the efficacy of these agents on trying to have control of the hormones that at the same time can have control of or improve quality of life. I think that will be an important endpoint. I'm not saying, you know, maybe not the primary endpoints, because we usually follow the most common oncological endpoints, but I think that will be important as well to acknowledge this aspect of these neuroendocrine tumors.
You mentioned quality of life, and I wanted to shift a little bit to talk about patients and what they need to go through in order to receive treatment. So rare tumor patients often have to travel far. They have to go to a specialized facility in order to get the treatment they need. How do you lessen the burden for these patients? So there's a number of different options, as you're well aware of. Televisits are becoming more popular. There's also more effort to collaborate with local clinics and communities so that patients maybe don't have to travel as far to larger centers for the treatment. But I wanted to ask you what, in your work, how you lessen or help lessen that burden for patients.
I have been very fortunate that I have seen patients from all over, you know, within the States and within the United States, that, to be honest, I feel like there is so much work that needs to be done, I mean, especially for rare cancers. And I see not only neuroendocrine tumors, but I see all these other rare subsets of cancers like pheochromocytomas and adrenocortical carcinoma, that even these patients suffer a lot more.
Mm-hmm. I think not everybody has the means to get to a NET center of excellence, for example, or a rare disease center of excellence. But what can the community at large do, or what can, you know, pharmaceutical companies do? Or how can we design clinical trials in a way that makes it accessible to patients, or makes it easy for them to even know where a clinical trial is that exists for their rare cancers?
It's true that management of rare cancers do require the opinion of expert in the disease. And I agree that patients, sometimes they need to travel long distance in order to see an expert, and that's sometimes not feasible for some patients. One way that I feel like we could improve, or maybe we can help, is provide more education, I think, for the physicians in the community. Provide education about these rare cancers. Patient advocacy, I think they're doing a very good job on trying to not only educate patients, but also at the same time provide resources available so that way even other providers can look into that. So I think that I have to say that patient advocacy, they're very powerful, because they advocate for patients and they also by the education needed. And I think that's a powerful resource and tools as well for these patients, so that we can help. But I feel that in center of academic institutions, you know, at least there may be someone who be familiar with neuroendocrine tumors, and then even maybe some of these specialists may even try to call someone who they know, they have expertise, to provide some guidance. But I feel like it's the physicians in the community that maybe we need to, you know, provide more education and guidance about this disease and what the treatment options are out there. Also, I was fortunate to be able to co-chair the ASCO guidelines for management, systemic therapies for neuroendocrine tumors, as well as the symptom management, because we realized that, you know, these patients with neuroendocrine tumors, not only we need to have the treatments needed in order to have control of tumor growth, but at the same time, the symptom management associated with this and the complications associated with these tumors, the hormone excess. But the idea of doing that with ASCO is to be able to also have this tool available for physicians in the community, so that way they can provide some guidance as well. And the same with other organizations such as NANETs and ENETs, right, that provide resources for physicians to also educate themselves. I think that would be an area that, you know, maybe we reach out more to these physicians in the communities, medical oncologists, that, you know, there are options. I mean, of course, we need more options or better options, but there still are options for these patients.
It's an excellent point, because, and this is just speaking from my own background, I'm used to working in large academic centers. So this is where things are being run through clinical trials, where new things are being discovered, where new treatments are being tried. And it's understandable that that's not going to be happening in a lot of the local community hospitals. Are going to be following standard of care procedures. So how do you bridge, which is a whole other really exciting topic that we could go into another time. How do you bridge that? ASCO, you know, is one great resource. There's other organizations that I would be interested in learning more about, but really bridging that gap so that patients with rare diseases don't have to go far from home to at least have options, or at least be able to speak to someone who knows about options for them.
Yeah, and no, that's a very good point and an excellent question. And one of the things I mentioned earlier was about education, right? Provide education, resources, more resources. I feel like sometimes for physicians in the community, some may not necessarily know or are aware of these resources, may not have the time as well. But increasing awareness, I mean, increasing awareness of these neuroendocrine tumors. One of the things that we say about WNET community is our patients are very motivated. They're very smart. They ask about their disease and their life and how that impacts everything. And they ask questions and they look for resources. Sometimes I feel like our patients know a lot more than even some of these doctors, just because they look for those resources. And I think medical oncologists also should be able to have access to that and be open to that information. I think that I understand, you know, how do we help or close that gap? All I can think is about providing resources, providing education, more awareness of these tumors, and also provide with information that if this is something that is not available near you, what other options do we have? For example, if we have somebody in the community, a patient that in order to get to the next academic center is like 3 or 4 hours away from where they are, and it's very difficult for that patient, you know, to travel. But if that's the case, you know, what options are available of the proof ages of other options that the physician can provide, right? And I think all that information is important to know. I mean, what options we know that, you know, may be available, we think it will be the next line of therapy for the patient, but also understand, you know, the socioeconomic status of the patient. So that way, you know, provide options, and then we don't tell them like, well, this is the option that you need, and you need to go like 4 hours away when the patient doesn't have the means to do
right.
that.
Tailor right. the option to the patient's circumstances as much as possible.
Yeah. So yeah. And I think that's important. So and that also comes again with education and awareness and to do more of that. And that's why I'm saying, you know, patient advocacy is really wonderful. You know, if I were a physician in the community, it's like just, you know, 5 minutes to look what is out there, or what is the patient advocate, how we can learn, what are the options, and provide all the options possible for this patient.
You bring up a good point also about the diversity reaches out to a patient's resources, right? So their economic status, what options are available on that level. That's also inclusive in the, when you talk about diversity in healthcare, in clinical research, it's being able to provide options for those patients as well from all different economic backgrounds. That's a good point. So my understanding is that you lead NCI's natural history study for neuroendocrine neoplasms and ACC. So for our listeners, and in particular listeners who may not have a research background, how do you explain why observing disease over time mattered just as much as testing drugs? And tied into that, if you could maybe talk a little bit about what is meant by a natural history study.
Yes, I'm happy to discuss more about the natural history study. So a natural history study is here at my institutions, is a way to follow patients over long periods of time and understand more about their disease biology, disease progression, and over time understand also if there is any commonalities among patients that help us understand more about the molecular underpinnings of the patients, the biology, even when we look at scans, you know, whether there may be any difference or anything that we can change in terms of their management. I do feel NAT history studies are very important, especially for rare cancers where patients are seen not only for a long period of time, but it's very systematic as well. And then we can obtain more information about their family history, their exposure, their even, you know, how they feel over time, what treatments the patients responded, what do we see in the scans. If we studied the tumor, you know, how do we see in the tumor? How do we understand whether there is any different molecular characterization that helps understand more about these tumors that at the end will help us understand more and be able to develop better therapies, understand whether there's any prevention tools, whether, you know, if there is anything that we can do to improve the quality of life based on what we have learned. So I think the natural history study has different endpoints. for which help us understand more about patients and improve their quality of life and the well-being of the patients. So I think that's one of the things that is important about these studies.
So it sounds like a very holistic look at the patient situation and sort of looking at things at a much more granular level, if I'm understanding correctly, like really expanding, looking at each different step, but almost questioning each different step and how you got to that point. But that holistic look as well in terms of the circumstances surrounding the patient. Is that fair? Am I getting that right?
In a way, yes. I mean, this kind of like more into depth of the tumors. And one thing that we are studying about these patients is also understanding the quality of life via patient-related outcomes. And that's one of the works that I did as part of the natural history study within the NIH. We are about to publish that information about studying these patients, how they're affected day-to-day life, and what does that mean to have this diagnosis, and ways to improve that. Because I think that as we all understand, whenever someone of any of us hear the word cancer, is like there is nothing else, and it's kind of like so many thoughts comes to mind, right? And how that affect their quality of life and their thought process and the treatment options, and in a way, you're trying to also understand ways to help them to go through their journey of having this diagnosis.
Changes your life overnight. Everything just completely goes out the window, and you have to completely restructure how you're going to live the rest of your life, or at least until you get to a point where the disease is either under control or ideally.
That's correct. We also listed the study that we have here at the NIH. Also, one of the goals is to be able to understand whether there is any predictive or prognostic biomarkers by really studying the molecular characterization within the tumors and in blood. And we have, in my mind, a very unique tool here at my institutions where we put all that information into this, what we call tumor miner, and be able to understand whether we can determine there is any prognostic biomarkers, so if there is any marker that tells us whose patients are going to do worse than others, or if there are any predictive biomarkers, meaning if there is any target for treatments. So that's one of the things that we're doing with the study that I'm fortunate to lead, and that we have learned a lot, certainly, and throughout the time that I have been having the study and our patients, and we have been able to develop therapies because of that. So this is something that I'm definitely in depth to patients, and I'm really so grateful to them for doing that and being part of the study, because the idea is to be able to help them and help others as well in the future. By doing that, I actually, now talking about clinical trials, I do have a first-in-human study with an antibody drug conjugated. We learned that by seeing a patient as well and understanding a very specific marker. And with that, you know, there is a company that we also work with to develop this antibody drug conjugated. And with that, we have now our first-in-human study. And currently, we're leading this study. And we learned. I mean, we certainly learned. That's kind of the most important. Find different tools that we can learn in order to improve the quality of life of our patients via, you know, treatments or, like I say, different tools that we can find. Yeah.
So you mentor a lot of fellows, right? And I think that you are an inspiration in many ways. But I think for a lot of people to see a Latina woman that is very, you advocate for, I think, people across the world, you're an advocate for me, you're an advocate for everybody that really kind of comes through your institution, and you bring everybody up. And what is the one thing that you like to express on others when you're training?
I think whenever I have somebody, a fellow, a student that, you know, wants to work with our team, work with me. So one of the things that I usually ask is like, you know, what can I do for you? So sometimes you feel the relationship is like, well, I'm this, and this is, these people come, you know, what they can do for me, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, I feel like sometimes the relationship is more successful when you're trying to understand and learn what the person's aspirations are. And that's usually what I ask, you know, what can I do for you? You know, what are your plans? What do you expect getting from these? You know, so that way we can build around that. And by doing that, I actually, the person who's working with me learned that at the same time I'm learning too. I think it's beneficial for everyone, I feel, because I'm also learning to, you know, understand as well, you know, how I can help and bring the best of other people too. I think that's one of the satisfaction that I have, because I feel that, you know, when you provide information and you see them grow, that's kind of like to me the biggest satisfaction that, you know, in life.
Yeah.
So I feel I have done something that may be worthwhile. And that's kind of like where, you know, I see that in some of the students see them move to the next phase in their career and being able to do what they want without feeling that work and, you know, what is the end of this? So I think that's to understand their aspirations, their goals, their needs, and to build on that is, I think, to me, that's something important. And we all learned. I learned, they learned. I think this is all, life is a learning process. Even Tina, this for many years, you know, like I still feel like, yes, somebody may consider an expert, but at the end of the day, you know, you're still learning from life. Life is a learning process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At any age, it doesn't end.
Yeah.
For the youngsters out there. It's not good. You're not going to plateau ever.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing. Keeps things exciting.
Yeah. I agree. That's what I was going to say. You know, by doing that, I feel like, you know, you have energy and aspirations and motivations and, you know, you can keep going. And I feel like that gives me satisfaction too.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's do a quick fire. Okay. First thought that comes to mind when I ask each one. Okay. Favorite conference city so far?
Oh, wait, I have to think.
First one. What's the first one that comes to mind?
Oh my God, I don't know. I mean, when you ask me this, I feel like so many things. You know, like my mom was, and then after that, it's like not a favorite one. I mean, it's got like every place. It has their charm and their unique.
Yeah. You gotta have a favorite though. There's gotta be one that stands out.
Let me see. I mean, I like Vienna. I remember Inet.
Vienna was nice. Vienna was
lovely. Good coffee.
I like Prague, Italy, you know, as well.
Yeah.
You know,
so, okay.
So, yes, I think a lot of the European countries have their own charm and, you know, uniqueness and maintain, you know, their buildings so nicely. So I think it's nice to see. The curiosity that I always have is when you go to cities, understand how the city is where it is, you know, what is the background and their, you know, history behind. I'm always curious to see that. So, and, you know, how they form and how they work, where they are, right? So that's kind of like curiosity that I have, you know, whenever I go to these cities.
Okay. A paper that you wish you would have authored?
That already happened? You mean
that
like,
already happened? Yeah. Can be before our time. It doesn't have to be something recent.
Well, a paper that I'm trying to work on that I want to do is models, you know, preclinical models. We know that clinical models in neuroendocrine tumors are very difficult and some of them non-existent, even for paraphilias and other rare diseases. But the reality is that it's hard to replicate, right? What is happening on the mice to humans and the percentage of drug that has been approved when that process has been achieved is less than 5%.
Okay.
So I think that something that I would like to explore and write something that maybe unique is trying to understand, hey, you know, maybe we need to make a difference here in terms of preclinical models. This is really what is needed to establish other ideas. And organoids is a good idea too. And maybe I'm a little bit biased because I'm seeing a rare cancer that doesn't have models. And maybe that's what I'm saying. That will be a paper that will be interesting to kind of like establish all that concept.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing that. I'm sure you're going to do it.
One more question. So with everything that you've talked about, and I can tell that you are extremely passionate about the work that you do and very passionate about the patients and their well-being, I think to a degree that I haven't seen expressed in such a lovely way very frequently. So with all that in mind, what's given you genuine hope for rare tumor patients now in the work that you're doing?
One of the things that give me hope is the patient itself. I mean, is my patients give me, and my patients definitely drive my interest to ask more questions. You know, I think science is about asking questions, right? Asking questions and how do we answer those questions? This is what science is about. But my patients are the ones who keeps me motivated, and the hope is basically my hope. You know, like that's all I can say. I mean, I know that science and research, you know, sometimes is long, it can be hard, it can be, you know, difficult. Sometimes you may not be successful, and that's what the research is all about. Sometimes in order to get one good answer, you have to get 10 wrong answers. But I think the persistence of doing that is important. But I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't see my patients, you know, understanding what they go through and hope. That's what they give me hope. I mean, I'm trying to do my best in the studies that we're doing and trying to understand and trying to help our patients. But that's what gives me hope. And I'm not sure one answer is my patients.
Yeah, that's very powerful.
And I think at the end of the day, if we can help one patient, I mean, I feel like if I help one patient to like feel better, you know, that to me means a lot more than, you know, all the things, you know. But yeah. It's a process. Everything in life is a process.
It is. It is. And I think that's why we're all in what we're in. And that's why we're all doing what we're doing. But thank you so much. I think everybody listening is going to walk away having learned something and felt something after listening to today's episode. So thank you for showing a glimpse into what you do every day and all the rare cancers that you treat. And we hope we can bring you on again in the future. And we look forward to our collaboration always. So if anybody listening gained something today, please share the episode with somebody that you know. Somebody that might want to know something and have no idea what research means or what any of these rare cancers we treat look like. And join us next time as we uncover another study and another person behind the studies. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.